why is emergency services like that? I've never understood that. So getting back to that, I try to tell my guys that as long as you can lay your head down at night and know that you have set yourself up and trained yourself to the best of your abilities to make a difference, you shouldn't have to worry about the mental health problem. If you lay your head down on your pillow at nighttime and you sit there and think, if I would have got off the couch, or if I would have pulled that hose line two more times in training to get it just right, if I would have looked at the fire truck today and saw that the hose wasn't packed correctly on the truck, and I would have fixed it this morning, then that person wouldn't be dead. Mm-hmm. Make sure that every day that you come to the firehouse that you are studying, learning, doing something to make the next incident easier or better. And as long as you're doing that, then you should be able to lay your head down at night and be confident that you did all you could. And some things are just out of your hands. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the mindset that I try to teach my guys.
Fearless Patched, der Podcast, der Menschen eine Stimme gibt, die sich in ihrem beruflichen Alltag furchtlos psychischen und physischen Herausforderungen stellen. Ihr Host Tom kennt diese Herausforderungen aus erster Hand. 10 Jahre lang hat er bei Spezialeinsatzkräften seinen Dienst versehen. Begleiten Sie ihn in eine verborgene Welt und hören Sie echte Geschichten von Menschen, die dort bestehen, wo andere zurückweichen.
Viele glauben, dass die größte Belastung für Einsatzkräfte durch besonders dramatische Ereignisse entsteht. Mein heutiger Gast sieht das differenzierter. Jeremy ist seit über 20 Jahren Feuerwehrmann in den USA, Fire Captain und Ausbilder. Er ist überzeugt, dass die eigentliche Herausforderung oft erst danach beginnt, wenn man sich fragt, ob man mehr hätte tun können. Wir sprechen über posttraumatische Belastungsstörung, PTSD, Führung unter Druck, den Unterschied zwischen amerikanischen und europäischen Feuerwehren und darüber, warum konsequente Vorbereitung der beste Schutz gegen Schuldgefühle sein kann. Die Folge haben wir direkt vor Ort in den USA aufgenommen und ausnahmsweise vollständig auf Englisch geführt. Ich hoffe trotzdem, dass ihr viele wertvolle Impulse daraus mitnehmt. Viel Spaß mit Fearless Patched.
Willkommen bei Fearless Patched. Heute eine besondere Folge. Ich bin zu Besuch in Atlanta, USA, im Bundesstaat Georgia gerade. Und habe mir gegenüber sitzend den Jeremy, einen amerikanischen Firefighter. Und deswegen werden wir das Gespräch jetzt in Englisch fortführen. Jeremy, welcome to Fearless Patched.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me in my podcast. And it's a pleasure to have you here. So let's dive into your story. Can you briefly introduce yourself and tell us what motivated you to become a firefighter?
I've been in the fire service for 23 years now. Started out as a volunteer back in 2002, and then started a career department in 2003. What actually drove me into the fire service is I went on a Christian membership, a mission trip in Africa, actually, back in 2001. And when I flew back into America, and I really was thinking, you know, what did I want to do? I wanted to get into something where to help people. I really felt that was, in my goal of life to try to help people, not just work for no reason, but that kind of thing. So then of course 9/11 happened the same year. Yeah. So it kind of triggered it as well. It's like, you know, that's, you know, yes, a lot of people pay the ultimate sacrifice to save a lot of people, but a lot of people were saved because of guys that are still alive today. Mm-hmm. So that kind of drove me into the fire service. I've always been kind of an adrenaline junkie too. you know, I played baseball and wakeboard and stuff like that, but, like dirt bikes and four wheelers and all that kind of thing too. So it was a kind of adrenaline thing. I was like, hey, maybe I'll try firefighting. That looks pretty cool. So that's how I really got into it, and dove right in, and it's definitely been my passion for years. You know, I love the fire services.
Cool. Before we talk to the fire service especially, you talked about you were on a mission in Africa.
Yep.
What have you done there?
We built a church in Botswana.
Okay.
Yep.
How long have you been there?
That was only a month.
A month.
Mm-hmm. That was July 10th, August 10th of 2001, actually.
Yeah. Okay, and you came back and immediately 9/11 happened.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I actually have pictures where we were at JFK Airport exactly 1 month before it.
Wow.
And took pictures and had pictures of the World Trade Center and everything back then. Yep. So it's ironic that it all happened right around that time. And then, like I said, I really got to looking into the fire service then. Mm-hmm. And then dove in both feet.
Okay.
Yep.
And how do you become a firefighter in the U.S.? How does this?
Unfortunately, it doesn't take the amount of education and stuff as a lot of the European countries do. If I'm not mistaken, I have watched, you may have heard of him before, the Swedish fire nerd. He's on YouTube.
Yeah.
He does like, God, his podcast and YouTube video is like 4 hours long. He interviews a lot of American firefighters and stuff like that. And, it sounds like over in Europe, there's a lot more, like college education involved in the fire service as to where here in America, we actually hire people at 18 years old now, and put them through what we call firefighter certifications.
Yeah.
Which is it's basically created through the National Fire Protection Association. And, it's a minimum requirement, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Like it should be way harder.
Yeah.
But unfortunately the public service, it's just like police, fire, EMS, it's getting harder and harder to find people to get into those careers.
Okay.
So you go through about a 12 to 16 week, recruit academy, where you learn your basic firefighting from ladders to search to, hose movement. Building construction is a really big, important thing here in America too, since, as me and you spoke the other day about building construction is totally different here.
Yeah. Yeah.
than in Europe. So our firefighting techniques are a little bit different as well. So then once you get that stuff done, then you have to become an emergency medical tech. And it's all in the same. We don't have an ambulance in our, at my fire department, we don't have an ambulance.
Yeah.
New York, Chicago, the larger cities, they have their own ambulance service within the fire department. Mm. It's a division of the fire department.
But it's always in the fire department. So also in the big cities, it's part of the fire department, but the ambulance is a specialized unit in this department.
So yeah. Smaller cities, like the city of Burlington where I work, we don't have an ambulance service. The county does.
Mm-hmm.
So they are our ambulance service. So the fire truck runs out first, because we're more centrally located to the areas so we can get there faster. So we get there and start basic life support, on vehicle accidents or, anywhere from traumas to heart attacks to overdoses to you name it. The joke in the fire service is when in doubt, punch us out, because they'll dispatch us to anything and everything.
Okay.
If they have no idea who to send to it, they send the fire department.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you have to be well equipped and well trained in a lot of parts.
Yep.
So not just firefighting, also emergency cases.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember when you started? Can you remember when it was the first time you had an emergency call or where there was a specific emergency case where you recognized, okay, now I'm a firefighter, now I'm doing this? Or is it?
Yeah, I was actually telling some of my guys the other day, the first fire I ever went to was with my volunteer department back then. I wasn't a paid fireman anywhere then. I volunteered at a place called Hall River Fire Department. It's a little bitty fire department. At the time we ran probably 400 calls a year, maybe. And it was almost 100% volunteer. And so the pager went off. I jump in my car, take off to the station, get there, grab all my gear and jump on the fire truck. And we take off. And I'm riding in the back of the fire truck. It was a utility truck, not a fire engine that we were on. And we're heading down the street and I can't see anything. And I look out the window and I see an orange glow and I'm like, oh, I guess this is what I signed up for. I guess I'm gonna figure it out tonight.
Yeah.
So we get there and, I get out of the back of the truck with all my stuff and I'm like, all right, wow, what do I do now? And one of the officers that was with me, he was like, all right, come on, let's go. We got to go here and blah, blah, blah. So it ended up throwing a ladder to the second floor window, and the house is rocking. There's fire blowing out of every window of the second floor of this house. And he's like, you got to go up that ladder and take the hose up there and put the fire out on the second floor. And I'm like, okay, I'll figure this out, I guess. I mean, I had no training at the time.
Okay.
So I take the hose, I'm climbing up the ladder, I've got my air pack on, which they showed me how to use that. That's about
they
it.
They showed it just that, to you. It was not, do you need a long training for this?
No. I think I had been there a few Monday night trainings, I still go to training on Monday nights for my volunteer department. And, Monday nights we meet up there and we create some training for the night. So we went over the air pack a few times. I put it on. They showed me what to do if something went wrong with it.
Okay.
And, that was about it. And then, I remember they said the staircase inside the house completely burned away. So the only way that we could get to upstairs was by that ladder. So, I climbed this ladder up and I got the hose and I'm spraying water and trying to put the fire out. And I'm like, I guess I'm doing this right. I don't really know what's going on. So climbing through the window and continue to put fire out. And, I actually ran into another fireman in there and,
Where was he coming?
So he ended up coming up the stringers of the staircase. You know, the stringers are the part that the step treads actually attached to.
Yeah.
That was still there, but each step was burned away.
Wow.
So he actually climbed up that stringer and met me on the second floor. And I ran into him like, how the hell did a fireman get up here? Like, where did you come from? That guy ended up, he was with a different department. He's a very good mentor of mine for many, many years after that. And, he actually just passed away, two or three months ago. Mm-hmm. Very good guy. He's, his son is a police officer, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. He works in the same city I do, but he's a fire investigator through the police department.
Okay.
Yeah. So, that's pretty cool. But yeah, that was the first fire I ever ran. I was like, wow, this was really cool. So then I've kind of had the bug ever since.
Okay. You already talked about this. So we were together. You ran into another firefighter. How important is it to the teamwork in firefighting?
Well, we do everything in twos. No matter what, we always have at least a pair of people.
So this was the only time when you were alone?
Well, you got to remember this is 2002, so that's 22, 23 years ago.
Yeah.
Now we're a whole lot more strict in the fire service on multiple people being together. And the sad part is we're way understaffed no matter what we do.
Yeah.
So two is about the best we can offer in a group. For instance, on a house fire, I respond with, three engine companies, a ladder truck, a rescue vehicle, which is our heavy rescue. It does like vehicle extrications, confined space, those kind of things. It responds with us and then two chiefs, to take command and safety and do all that jazz. So we have typically 17 to 18 people on a house fire. Mm-hmm. And we all work in groups of two, three, sometimes four. We just mesh together, with whatever tactic has to be done.
Okay. So, this would be different. This is different today than it was in the younger days when you started. Mm-hmm. You said now it's more teamwork. It's more that at least two firefighters
that
work together.
We try to do that the best we can. In the volunteer fire service, it's whoever can show up.
Mm.
So, I mean, most of these guys and girls work full-time jobs somewhere. They're at their houses, and that's the only time they can respond.
Mm.
So there's multiple times where, department will get there and there might be one guy on a fire truck.
Okay. Well,
and they're waiting for other departments to show up and the volunteers to show up. And so, yeah, the more rural areas of the United States, I can't remember the numbers. It's pretty wild that, I think it's like 80%, 85% of the United States is covered with volunteer departments the same way.
89%.
It's very high.
Wow. Okay.
It might be in the 70s now.
Yeah.
Because even my volunteer department is having to hire part-time people.
Yeah.
To work. And typically they're full-time firefighters somewhere else. And on their off days, they come there to work. And that's the only way we can staff it. Cause the way it works in America is years ago,
it's a big country.
it was led by farmers. Yeah. There was so much farmland and so many farmers that they'd be out plowing their fields. And a phone would ring or they'd get flagged down or what they use now and what is on our firehouse is the air raid alarms.
Okay.
You guys have the air raid alarms in Europe?
Yep. In Austria, where I'm coming, it's this air raid alarms where the volunteers are alarmed. And I think in some countries they thought about they don't need it anymore. And there was sometimes a catastrophe because they don't have these alarms. Yeah. When can they start to become firefighters?
Now they will. You can start your certification classes in high school now.
Okay.
So at 16, 17 years old, they can start taking, they can't do, actual live fire. So they can't be next to fire, but they can start learning. They can't be in what we call IDLH, immediately danger to life and health atmosphere. Mm-hmm. They can't be in that at all.
Okay.
They don't allow them or allow you to teach to that level that young, but as soon as you're 18, you can. So, the age limit, I guess, it just hasn't changed.
Yeah.
I guess that's just part of it, but, trying to take people too young into those atmospheres. Mm-hmm. I can see why.
Yeah.
I don't want to teach them at that age because they're not mature enough to not hurt themselves.
Hurt themselves. And what is it about the psychological, emotional component? You see, terrible situation as a firefighter.
Yeah. That's the thing is, it's hard to even understand the things that you will see when you're 18, 19, 20 years old. Mm-hmm. But now we're hiring guys that have never mowed a yard before. They don't know how to even crank a chainsaw because they've never had to do it. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you take a city like Atlanta right now. If you have a person that grew up in the city in an apartment,
of course,
they've never touched any of that stuff before.
Of course.
Well, we have to maintain our own fire stations. We have to.
I had to learn it by myself. I was also grown up in a city, and when I came to the police to the breaching work, and then to get into the flat or into a house.
Yep.
And I wasn't able to do that. I had to be trained. Yeah. Sorry, I would interrupt you.
Yeah, no, it's a lot to teach these people these days, these young folks. Cause, you know, like I said, years ago, people were out in their yards more. They were out learning, how to take care of farmland or working on tractors or, you know, doing the trades that nobody wants to do nowadays. For some reason, everybody wants to get out of the trades, learning how to, plumbing, building, all of that stuff. Nobody wants to do that.
Yeah. I think it's the same problem in Europe right now. Yeah.
Yeah. I personally think it's the school system teaching them, hey, go sit in the office and hopefully you'll make $1 million a year.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, then why aren't you?
Yeah.
If you're telling everybody this, why are you not doing that?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's become pretty interesting, but we still get quite a few guys that are, that grew up in the country and learned how to do all this stuff. And they're a huge help.
All right. So stay a little bit more about these psychological challenges. When they come as a young volunteer or when they start to 16 in high school, but I think many people see firefighters, of course, as heroes and, but really think about the emotional toll. So what is the hardest part mentally after tough calls and tough emergency cases? How do you deal with this?
Dark humor.
Yeah.
Dark humor is probably the number one. The jokes, the laughter, trying to, it's that old adage where they used to say, sometimes you have to laugh so you don't cry.
Yeah.
It's kind of one of those things where, the dark humor has to help.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make light of whatever situation. And then over time you learn to forget, or, it gets so far back in the Rolodex that you kind of phase it out. Some things never go away. Mm-hmm. You never get rid of those. And that's why PTSD is a real big issue in police, fire, military. Because it's a daily trauma that people see that the public doesn't really understand. So, there's another, European podcaster, James Gearing,
mm-hmm.
from Behind the Shield podcast.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that one before?
No, I've not.
I listen to his a lot. He's really big into and he interviews a lot of different, I guess same as you're doing with police, fire, military, and that kind of thing. And he talks a lot about PTSD and learning how that works and the amount of trauma. If you take the average person that might see one vehicle accident, one bad vehicle accident their whole life.
Yeah.
And we go to three in a shift.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's, or you could go to, this past week I've had two house fires, a vehicle rollover, at least 30 to 40 medical calls.
Mm.
Now those in our shift in three shifts.
Mm.
So we work 24 hours on and 48 hours off is how our shifts work.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they do it in Austria. But.
I think in Austria it's, as I said, we have a big volunteer system. I think in the biggest cities you have some kind of 24 hours and then off. 24 hours, and then they have, I think, 2 days mm-hmm. in a row or something like this.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some departments that have, we call it the 3-4 schedule,
mm-hmm.
Is what that sounds like, where you work 24 hours on. So one day on, one day off, one day on, one day off, one day on, and then 4 days off.
Yeah, I think it's some kind of this, but I'm not familiar. I'm more familiar with the police system, and the police system is that you have 12-hour duties,
mm-hmm.
And you have 24 hours between.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have after three, so you have a day shift, 24 mm-hmm. hours, night shift, 24 hours, day shift,
yep.
24 hours. And then 2 days off. But a lot of times you don't make 12 hours. You have to make 24
yep.
hours. And then you have just 12 hours to the next yep. shift. Maybe you take another 24 hours.
Yeah. It's amazing that honestly, if you look at it, the emergency services across the world
mm.
is like the most abused
yeah.
system in mm. the world. Like they're from sleep deprivation to over hours worked. We actually had I just saw it this morning. We had just had a city in North Carolina that is talking about revoking vacations and sick time from their firefighters.
Yeah.
Revoking some of it. Like we work 56 hour work weeks.
Yeah.
And we're mandated by people who work 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
Like.
And having home office.
Yep. And police are the same.
Yeah.
And then you expect people to work this amount of hours and see the things they do and operate at 110%.
Right.
It's absolutely insane.
Never make mistakes.
Yep.
Ever make the right decisions.
Especially with police. You take police officers that, you know, that just went to a terrible domestic, incident, and then 10 minutes later they're going to grandma complaining because the music is too loud next door.
Right, right, yeah.
And they're like, do you not know what a real problem is?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and it's the same for us as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll pull somebody out of a vehicle and send them to the hospital and hope they make it. And then 10 minutes later, somebody called 911 because their toe hurts. It's absolutely insane. And then for us to hold our composure and be nice to them. Like it's insane. Yeah, if you really think about it.
Yeah.
And then of course you got, athletes and professionals making millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And public service is like, hey, we'll give you enough to survive. How about that? And make you work, continuously. You know, it's really crazy when you look at how they treat emergency services across the world. And it's, you know, I've had friends that are nurses and work in hospitals and stuff, and it's like, y'all do realize we don't know any of this stuff when we get there. Like, we're bringing them to y'all and tell y'all all this stuff.
Yeah.
But we're seeing the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing when you look at it. You know, you couldn't pay me enough to be a police officer.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Maybe you couldn't pay a police officer enough to be a firefighter.
Yeah. It's exactly. Well, they all try to run in. They always try to run in house fires.
Yeah.
Well, police officers save a lot of people out of house fires, believe it or not.
Because they're always there early first. At the scene than you sometimes, or
they beat us there, and I mean they're in their little cars and they can get there so much faster. So a lot of times they get there before the fire has grown to the level it has by the time we get there.
Yeah.
So they do a very good job with it. We pick with them and give them a hard time.
Yeah.
And so sometimes they go where they shouldn't go, but yeah, they do a good job with it too. I've actually had family that was in the police department as well.
Okay.
My stepbrother was a police officer for a few years.
Okay.
But he had some incidents that drove him out as well. That drove him out of the emergency services with, people pointing guns at him and things like that. He said it's not worth it and got out of it.
I think it's a complete different situation here in America. And I think, this is also, I think a good thing that we talk now, because, I think Europe has a very specific view on the Americans and on the emergency services and why do police officers shoot so often and this doesn't happen in Europe. Yes, but more people are armed and more people point the gun at the police officer and, so everything comes from something. You talked about PTSD. How do your fire department deal with this issue, or do you have psychological support, or do you speak in the group, in the team, or what are you doing?
They're getting bigger on like stress debriefing afterwards. Like if we have a bad incident, they try to get everybody together and they'll have somebody come in and talk to you about it. If they choose to, it's optional for us for the most part. I personally, everybody's different, but I personally think, the time hanging out with my guys at the fire station, and like I said earlier, the dark humor and us talking about it, and us getting it off our chest together works much better than talking to somebody who has no idea.
Yeah.
They do that to police department all the time. They're like bringing us this person that has never been put in the situation and tell them to sit down and talk to you about it. It's like, have you ever had this happen to you before?
Yeah.
Oh no. The worst thing you've ever had happen to you is like somebody stole your grocery cart in front of you at the grocery store. Like, why are you talking to this person about that? So having the right people in place to be able to talk to first responders would be huge. And I think it's coming around because there's so many people understanding it and seeing it nowadays. That I think it's becoming a bigger problem that they're seeing to fix.
Yeah.
Because you know, even going back to 9/11, we even lost a lot of first responders during then, or after that in the years.
Yeah.
Following through from what they've seen and survivor's guilt and all of those different things that come up. But then those people notice the need for it. And now they're starting, you know, I guess company would sound bad, but they're starting companies where they can go around and talk to people, or you can contact them and talk about things if you want to talk about them. But, it seems like I do a lot of outside training is what we call it, where it's not at my department, where I've traveled all over the United States going to classes and conferences, and, smaller conferences are popping up all over the United States of firefighter conferences where, I'm part of a training group that does it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, we bring in instructors and they'll do an hour and a half talk or whatever. And there's always a section. There's always somebody there that is, that talks about the mental health and the physical health and the PTSD struggles in the fire service. And that it seems like there's always one of those classes. It's almost like they beat you up with it now.
Yeah.
But it's a good thing because people need to know it. People need to know and understand how they can get, talk to somebody about it, you know?
Okay. Do you think this has changed in the last 10 years, 20 years, or especially after 9/11 or in the last 5 or 10 years that it becomes more a topic?
I would say in the last 5 to 6 years, mm-hmm. it has become a really big topic.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, and when I first got into the fire service, there was none of that. Back in 2002 when I started, there was none of that.
Mm-hmm.
And from the guys that I worked for then, for 20, 30 years before then, there was absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't show emotion. You didn't talk about anything. Like, they just shrugged it off. But if you think about,
dark humor as well,
Okay. Yeah. The dark humor's always been there.
Yeah. Okay.
But when you look back farther and farther, most of your police and fire came from, military veterans.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what they're used to doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they come back in and they got those jobs because what other jobs could they get?
Yeah.
If you look farther back, the Irish settlers and stuff coming over from Europe took police and fire jobs. They took the dirtiest jobs that nobody else wanted, which was police and fire. And that's how it all evolved in America for the most part. So it was real big in New York and stuff is the Irish background. But so then military, you didn't ask questions. And that's how a lot of it evolved. Even when I first started working in the fire service, I have a captain that had been there 20, 25 years that was older than my parents. And it was, you didn't ask questions.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They tell you what to do and you go do it. Yeah. You didn't ask any questions.
Yeah.
Now it's like question after question after question after question all day long, which I'm fine with. I entertain that because how else do they learn? How else do you learn if you don't ask questions, right? But it was like the mindset back then was you just do it.
Of course, yeah. I think you already talked about this. For me, it's now 8 years ago that I was in the Vienna, was in the SWAT team. And as you mentioned, we talked after a big emergency case or a tough situation. And of course, nobody had a problem with it.
Right, right.
And, of course, it was nothing to me. I'm a strong man. But you talked about your specific view you had on the situation, like more in a tactical way. So I said, okay, I didn't see that there was a knife in the kitchen, but,
right.
And then I said, but yes, I saw the knife, but, I didn't see that, the weapon in the living room or something like this. And then it gets normal because you didn't see everything and another one doesn't see anything. So is this also a kind of, psychological, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you do this after big case?
We definitely do it after fires now or large events. Like I said, we just had a pretty substantial fire, last week. Not substantial as in like injuries or deaths or anything like that, but tactically we had some things that we got to hash out. Like our tactics weren't meshing together from crew to crew. So what we like to do after every fire is we try to meet up. Get all the crew members together and each company officer will say what their unit did. And then the next one will say what they did. And then we kind of converse. We actually have a paper we fill out that says like, challenges. What was your initial assignments? What were your challenges and obstacles? What would be a good thing to review and that kind of thing. We fill that out. And then, we fill those out and send them to one of our battalion chiefs. and he reviews them all. And then we come together in a meeting and talk about what could we do different? What could we do better? Cause no event is ever perfect.
Of course.
Doesn't matter. If you think it went perfect, then you probably did something wrong. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be the same from a SWAT raid to a house fire. There's always something that could be done better.
Yeah.
I mean, you take the military forces, the special forces, they train on the stuff constantly yeah. to get it perfect. Like the Blue Angels, pilots,
yeah.
you know about them in the Navy?
Yeah.
The blue airplanes that do all the, they actually sit in a room, before they ever fly. They all sit in a room and talk about every single step of those flights before they ever get out of the room. They have already gone over every single step. It's just like the special forces clearing rooms, right? Mm-hmm. You go in and you follow this wall and you don't even have a gun with you. You just mock it. Constantly do it. So you can always do stuff better. So we try to do that in a fire service, but how do you create fire without destroying something?
Yeah, and you do this, but you destroy houses by fire to train it.
Yeah, if somebody will donate a house to us, yes. Yeah,
okay,
cool. But most of them are not this nice houses.
This was very interesting for me, what you told me about yesterday.
Yeah, so if it, we can touch on that for a second. If the house isn't worth repairing and they're just going to tear it down, if it's safe enough for us to do stuff in, then we'll clear it out. There are extreme regulations on it, like way too extreme, to be honest with you. Cause we can't have, you're not supposed to have carpet on the floor.
Okay.
Because carpet burns different, right?
Yeah.
Carpet melts. You can't hurt somebody in training, or you shouldn't hurt somebody in training, but you also need it realistic as you possibly can.
Of course.
Yeah. Once we go through all the steps with that, with the Environmental Protection Agency and all that stuff, clearing us to burn it, then we put pallets and straw in it and we'll set a room on fire and come back and we'll get the students and they'll come in with a hose line and we'll talk them through the fire growth, how it proceeds out of the room, how your ventilation affects where the fire goes and how fast the fire grows. And how you can stop the growth of the fire with ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shut a door, keep it trapped behind a door, close the windows until they bust, of course. Mm-hmm. But we can show them all those things. But now with the administrative people, the chiefs, are so scared that something's going to happen and then it's going to be their fault that very few chiefs want us to do it anymore. And the EPA and the National Fire Protection Association is making it almost impossible for us to do it. Because the regulations are so bad. So then the only way we can do it now is to get, burn buildings. Well, burn buildings are made from shipping containers to concrete buildings, right?
Okay.
Which burn like stuff burns in Europe.
Yeah.
But they don't burn like stuff in America.
I see.
So the building construction is so different. As we talked about yesterday, and from what I know about you have to correct me, but from what I know about building construction there is it's all brick and concrete.
Right. Yeah. A lot of, yeah.
Yeah. So you're worrying about the contents burning, not the structure and the contents.
Right. Yeah.
Cause the bricks don't burn.
Yes.
For us, it's the walls. It's the ceiling. Everything burns in our structures. And once it gets past the drywall, it starts to get the structural components, the studs, the rafters, and it starts to burn that stuff. So it's a total different, application of water to put the fire out.
Mm.
I'm not sure about Austria as much. I guess they're all, fog nozzles and small droplets of water, trying to put fire out with steam versus.
Yeah, I'm not so specialized there, but I think it's like the way you said it. Yeah.
So that's more or less gas cooling because what happens with that is gas cooling. When you cool the smoke and the heat, then the fire should drop down as well.
Yeah.
And it creates very little water damage. But for us, we surface cool. because every surface burns.
Yeah.
So we have to put a large amount of water on every surface.
Yeah.
I know in some European nations that they use what's called a fog blast, where they just pop the nozzle and it just shoots a quick burst of water up in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then they can seal the room back.
We use this in riot control. If somebody gets burned, you have this high pressure water guns.
Yep.
And this is what you explained right now.
Yes. Yeah. And that would be gas cooling. The problem is it doesn't work that great in a well-ventilated area, a well-open space.
Yeah.
It has to be in a compartmentalized area, like a bedroom or a bathroom. And it can't, if the wind is gone, then it doesn't work as well. Because you don't have the gas contraction and you don't have the cooling process. So the majority of our construction in America now is wide open spaces. Mm-hmm. Your houses here, as to where you used to go in the front door, and then you would go down a hallway and every room had a door, right?
Yeah.
Now you go in the front door and you want to see the kitchen, the living room, the dining room, all in one spot. Yeah. Like it's just wide open. So to gas cool, in an area that large is almost impossible. Unless you have a huge amount of water flow. Cause steam expands, of course, but it doesn't expand enough. Once the windows are gone and stuff, then it just goes out the window with the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get water to the surfaces that are burning, not so much the gas contraction, because we have to be able to get the water farther into the compartment because the compartments are so much larger.
Yeah.
So it's funny on which social media is like kind of the devil on a lot of things, because I follow a lot of different fire departments in the United States, and I have a bunch of friends throughout the fire service. But it's so funny whenever we have videos of us cutting holes in roofs for ventilation, or
you showed me yesterday on the pictures,
and then going into house fires and flowing water and then you always have European firefighters that'll get on there and they'll be like, "Why do y'all do it that way? That is so dumb." Yeah. And then we have American firefighters that watch their videos and go, "Why do y'all do it that way? It's so dumb." And I won't lie, at times I've looked at that and said the same exact thing until I started looking into it and trying to be a student of the fire service and understanding, why is their firefighting different? Mm-hmm. Their firefighting is different because their construction is different. Mm-hmm. Their contents are different. I like to say firefighting is local. It's local to the area that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
I can't fight fire in Burlington, North Carolina, the same way that they fight fire in New York City. Now, fire still burns and water still puts it out, but the type of construction is different in a 100-story building versus a 1-story, 800-square-foot house, a very small house. So it's totally, you have to look at the whole thing.
Yeah.
Their gear is different in Europe. They mask up. They wear them weird, ugly motorcycle-looking helmets. And they pick on us about our cowboy-looking helmets, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's our tradition.
And the trucks are very different. I think this is something you recognize very specifically as a European, your big fire trucks.
And they're getting bigger and bigger. It's crazy.
Yeah.
That every truck that every new fire truck I've ever seen is bigger than the last one.
Okay.
And it's like, what are we doing? Why are we making the truck so big?
Fearless Patched ist unabhängig, getragen von echten Gesprächen und Erfahrungen. Wenn du solche Inhalte unterstützen willst, folge dem Podcast oder teile die Folge mit anderen.
Is it sometimes a problem to get to the place? Do you have enough space? I know everything is a little bit bigger here, and the streets are broad I think it's also difficult if you come to an area where the houses stand very close.
Yeah. We have some tight roads where that one fire truck is the only one that's going to fit and they're all going to stack up behind it.
Okay.
But our ladder trucks they're the hardest ones to maneuver around,
yeah.
which I don't know. I've never seen them in Europe. I don't know that they have. Have you ever seen the tiller trucks that we have? The ladder trucks that's a track trailer?
I've seen it just in the movies. Yep. I've not seen a big fire in the US. And these ladder trucks, I only know it from the movies and all that. You have behind, also you have the.
Yeah, you have a driver in the back of the trailer.
In the back of the train. Yeah.
And those trucks can, it is amazing what those trucks can do.
And I think it's also a different thing. I think in the US, it's more common to have very high buildings. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have some cities with higher buildings, but I think it's more common in the US.
Yep.
And maybe you need longer ladders.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are typically 100 foot,
yeah.
100, 110 foot.
Yeah.
I think the tallest one you can get in America right now, I think is 130.
Wow.
I think is as tall as you can get them. Now in China and Japan, they got some stuff that's like 200 and some foot ladders. It's insane.
Yeah.
They have like an elevator on it
mm-hmm.
that takes it up the platform. It's insane what they have.
You would also need a big truck.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, those look like, cranes, not ladder trucks. I mean, they're huge, but, that also brings in, you have to have outriggers, right? You have to have stabilizers that come out to make the footprint bigger.
Yeah, of course.
So that it doesn't tip over. Oh, yeah. Well, the problem that runs into with that is now you have cars on in the road in the way. You have police cars in the way because, you know, of course, they're going to get there as soon as they can to try to help out. So it's a big challenge to try to get those things set up.
Mm-hmm.
Laying your hose in from your hydrant, you know, all of that stuff is with traffic in small areas. The large parking lots and shopping centers are easy.
Mm-hmm.
You get off the out of the main roads and it gets way tighter. So, but that the maneuverability when these trucks get so large, you can't drive them as fast to get there. And you have to worry about them rolling over, right?
Yeah, of course.
which I think from the stuff I've seen on the internet, the German fire trucks are they're shorter, but they still seem pretty tall. I don't know. I've never been next
maybe,
to one.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
But they carry a lot of equipment that we have to put on other apparatus. Okay. We put a lot of our rescue stuff on a rescue type truck.
So you have a big tank in the okay.
Is that how they work in Austria too? Do they have?
I think you have different also specialized vehicles. Like I think what it's called Rüstlöschfahrzeug. I think this RLF. It's where you have the whole equipment and you always have a small tank somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you have like a main water vehicle and a more like equipment vehicle.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it's a little bit the same. And there's always, I think, a commanding vehicle who is the fastest and is the smallest and then tries to get there as a first responder. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And I think it's also very different if you're in a city or if you are on the countryside.
Right.
Yeah. But you told me right now, as a student, you try to be a student to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And you are also an instructor.
Yes.
So, how has this changed in the time? You are now for a firefighter for a very long time, very long period. How has training changed? And also maybe you can talk about the problem of PTSD. Mm-hmm. Do you bring this to the training? Do you train the younger firefighters that it's not everything will be, you know, strong, but maybe not strong enough for some situation?
So, I became an instructor because I saw things that I wasn't taught, and I wasn't taught things that correctly. So I wanted to be able to make that impact. And the biggest thing is I want to leave the fire service better when I leave than it was when I started.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make it better for the firefighters that I've trained. I want to make it better for the civilians that have to call. For us, training years ago, it was like you got trained when you started, and then you pretty much really didn't do much else.
Yeah.
Like every now and then we would pull a hose off the truck for a mandatory company drill that they made you do once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about it. There wasn't a whole lot else. Nowadays, becoming all hazard mitigation, there's so much stuff we have to train on, from hazardous materials to vehicle accidents to the EMT stuff to actual fires to active shooter stuff now. Like, it's all encompassed in, we do it all. It's like police are a lot of the same way, is they never say no. Mm-hmm. Oh, you need us to do this? Yeah. Yes, we can do that.
Yeah.
You need us to do that? Yeah, we can do that. Well, now you have to be a jack of all trades and a master of nothing, right? Yeah. It's like, you. I always pick about multitasking. Multitasking is halfway doing things right, ultimately.
Yeah, I think so.
But it depends on the amount of stuff, of course. But
of course.
So how do you get good at, how do you get really good at maneuvering hose and flowing water if you only do it every now and then because you have to go to EMT class all the time,
mm-hmm.
or you have to go to a public ed event, or like, how do you get good at these things while having to focus on so many other things, you know? You know, I relate it to law enforcement, is how much shooting do they actually get to do?
Yeah.
How much target shooting do they get to do? Yeah. How much high stress target shooting do they do?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have time for all of it.
Yeah.
They don't have time for what they need.
Yeah.
And that's why it's, of course you have SWAT, yeah. you have specialized yeah. guys that's what they specialize in, but
they're always the first on the scene.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't think our SWAT guys, typically in America, our SWAT guys don't run traffic stops. Like, yes. that's not what they do.
Like, yeah.
you know, you have a traffic division that does that stuff now. So they're not spread as thin.
Mm.
We don't have that in the fire service. I think somebody called 911 the other day, and because their pilot for their water heater wasn't lit.
Mm-hmm.
And they called the fire department. Can you come light our pilot to our water heater?
Yeah.
Well, no, I can't do that for you. You're going to have to call somebody else so that, yeah. that actually yeah. does that trade. Do I know how to? Yes.
Yeah.
But can I take a $1 million fire truck with three people on it away from a potential emergency to come light your pilot?
Of course.
Okay. Like, it's so crazy. Mm-hmm. The old joke, and it's still in books and stuff, is saving cats out of trees.
Yeah.
That's always been I've never had to go get a cat out of a tree.
Yeah.
But my joke to that as well is, when we have rookies, they're like, somebody will call the station and they'll be like, hey, there's a cat in a tree or something like that. And I look at them and say, hey, ask the person if they've ever seen a skeleton in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
They get down.
Yeah.
They don't need us.
They don't need us.
Yeah. But that's always been a joke about the American Fire Service, is you're going to get cats out of a tree.
Yes, of course. You have also, I think, situations where you think about, why are we here right
yeah.
now?
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe there's an emergency case where we are not, because we are here.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you asked about the, I guess, teaching about, PTSD
yeah,
and how to,
yeah, yeah.
So the way I confront that is, my opinion on the emergency side of that is, some things we can't control anything on. Mm-hmm. You show up to a active shooter event or something yeah. like that. There's only so much that we can control in that. When it comes to a fire and listening to the radio and getting on the truck as fast as you can,
mm-hmm.
getting on scene and being competent in your job and trained well makes us faster, smoother, and can make an impact on saving someone's life.
Yeah.
Can we always make that positive difference? No.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be, we have to realize that and understand that we can't fix everything that goes wrong. But what we can do is train ourselves to be competent enough so that we don't look back at ourselves and say, if I would have done this, then we would have been better off. Because I think that's the bigger side of the mental health issue in the emergency services, and in my opinion.
Mm.
because it's just like when my brother was in the police department, he was a real go-getter. So he was kind of hounded by some of the other guys as like, why do you go looking for things? Why are you always coming up on incidents? Why are you always like, just sit back, like relax. We'll come make a difference when we need to. And he's like, well, our job should be more proactive than that. We should be trying to help out. We should be making a difference. The fire service is exactly the same. My crew and the culture that we have at our firehouse is that we like to train and we like to stay up on our job and we want to be the best of the best when we get there. Well, not everybody likes that in the mercy services. So, it's the joke is, no one hates a firefighter like another firefighter.
Okay.
It's crazy. Nobody hates a police officer like another police officer. You know, it's insane, that we don't just all look out for each other and all want to be better. But ego plays a big, big part of that. And when somebody is outperforming you typically as a male, you don't want to be outperformed by it. It's a competition. So, but instead of stepping their game up and becoming better, they just want to trash talk you.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why is a mercy services like that? I've never understood that. So getting back to that, I try to tell my guys that as long as you can lay your head down at night and know that you have set yourself up and trained yourself to the best of your abilities to make a difference, you shouldn't have to worry about the mental health problem. If you lay your head down on your pillow at nighttime and you sit there and think, if I would have got off the couch or if I would have pulled that hose line two more times in training to get it just right, if I would have looked at the fire truck today and saw that the hose wasn't packed correctly on the truck and I would have fixed it this morning, then that person wouldn't be dead. Or we could have made a more of an impact in that situation. Maybe if I wasn't out in the parking lot at the station so far away from the apparatus, maybe I could have gotten there sooner. You got all of that stuff takes into account, like how far you're responding and all of these decisions we make all day long set us up for success or failure when it comes up to the emergency. So as long as you're confidently staying in the success or proactive motion, you shouldn't lay your head down at nighttime and say, I could have done something more. Right?
Yeah.
So I train my guys and teach my guys, hey, look, if you sit in a recliner all day and watch TV, are you doing anything to make the situation better? Okay, now you take that and you run a call in a little while and a child was left in a house fire and you couldn't find them. Are you going to lay your head down at night and say, if I wasn't sitting there watching TV today, I could have practiced my search. I could have read something on search. I could have watched a YouTube video on search. Like every little thing can help, right?
Right.
This is kind of crazy that I'm actually doing a podcast right now because I listen to podcasts a lot. And my guys have actually joked and asked when I was going to be on a podcast. It's pretty funny. I told them never, but here I am.
And now you're on a German speaking podcast right
there. Right. It's kind of ironic, So I tell them like, make sure that every day that you come to the firehouse that you are studying, learning, doing something to make the next incident easier or better. And as long as you're doing that, then you should be able to lay your head down at night and be confident that you did all you could. And some things are just out of your hands. That's kind of the mindset that I try to teach my guys.
Cool.
And then when you bring that up to them, now they think about it more. You know, throughout the day, they're like, you know, I've been sitting here too long, or, you know, maybe I should try this, or maybe I should look more on my truck today because if this were to happen, am I prepared? And obviously you'll never be 110% prepared for everything.
Of course.
But we've got to try to be.
And you have to make decisions, and maybe the decision is a wrong decision.
Yep.
You have to deal with this.
Yep. You're exactly right. And you have to teach as you go, and you have to continue to learn. You have good and bad people to learn from, right? Sometimes you learn more from bad than you do from the good, right? It's the same way as, you know, I was I had some company officers that really didn't like how they did anything. I didn't like how they talked to people. I didn't like how they treated their crews. You're always going to have those people. But that's where you learn the leadership from to, hey, I'm not going to do that. I learned very well that that doesn't work. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And you adapt and you learn from those things and bring it all together. So as an instructor, you try to teach all of those things back. And you try to share that knowledge and, that the knowledge, compassion, empathy, all of those things you try to share with them, so that they don't end up having the problems later on. I think that was, I have a guy that's, my fireman now was in the Marines and he was, he did quite a few tours over in Afghanistan and stuff. And you know, he, in that atmosphere, they do a 1 year tour typically. And they see a lot of stuff in that 1 year, but that's the only year that they hopefully have to go through that.
Yeah.
Right. So they can get a little bit long-term care.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in America, veterans are shafted. They're nowhere taken care of the way they should be by no means.
Yeah.
But they have a long lifespan after that, hopefully,
yeah,
that they can deal with that and get help for that. If you take police and fire, they spend 30 years doing it. And it's every single day.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and the call volume is not getting less. With your population brings more call volume.
Of course.
Yeah. Right. You said Austria's at 8 million.
Yeah.
You know, it's, we cover, I think somewhere around 60 to 65,000 people in my city with six fire trucks.
Wow.
And we run 11,000 calls a year. That sounds like a lot, but there's departments, take, San Francisco, California. They're, I think it's their engine three runs. I think they run like 20,000 calls, just that one truck, but it's a very highly populated area. Station nine in Los Angeles, Skid Row, the busiest firehouse in the nation.
Okay.
And they run 100 calls a day easy. Oh. It's insane.
It's insane.
They have four or five apparatus in that station, but that's in a small area.
Yeah.
And it's not in a great part of LA. There's homeless tents around their firehouse.
Yeah.
It's a bad area. You know, they run overdose after overdose after overdose. So you think about those guys running the, you know, all day long, you know, 10, 20, 30 calls a day, and then go home for a day, 2 days, and then come back, do it again. In the military, they go overseas for a couple months or a year, see really bad things for that short period, and it all gets compressed together. And then they can get help dealing with it when they come back. It's not a constant. So it's, and it's overlooked in the emergency services side a lot of times. And that's not casting any shade on the military.
No, of course not. It's different. Of course it's different. Do you also think, what I was always thinking about, if you have a situation where you have this psychological pressure and you don't feel so well after an emergency case and you talk about it, black humor, of course, everyone has his view. But it's also, I think it's also necessary, and I think this is the thin red line, that you have to be strong. Because tomorrow, everybody, you have to be responsible and you have to take care of your mates and you have to work.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's very difficult to talk about it. Do you see this also like this?
Yeah. I guess you just have to be strong and as open and transparent with everybody as you possibly can. Which is a blessing and a curse that I have. I'm way too transparent sometimes. You know, and I make sure that my guys never feel like they can't talk to me about something. I tell them all the time, my door is always open. You know, they can contact me by phone at any point. If we're off shift, and they need to call and talk to me about something, then I try to do the best I can to take care of that. because that's that could be a burden on them that they need to just talk it out. They mm-hmm. need to just however they can get by, get over it, I guess is a hard way of saying it. But and a lot of the younger guys, they're learning how to deal with it, as to where in my 22, 23 year career, a lot of this stuff I've seen, a lot of this stuff that I've had to deal with in the past, they're just now seeing. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of give some advice, or they feel like they can talk about it to me, because I've probably seen it before. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But if they didn't feel they could talk to me about it, then they're just going to bottle it up, and they're, mm-hmm. And then one day it's going to explode, or potentially mm-hmm. can, or they learn how to deal with it just as I did and other people do. Mm-hmm. I think a Detroit fireman in an interview said it the best I've ever heard. He said, I wish my mind could forget what my eyes have seen.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what you really can forget. It is absolutely amazing. What allows you to forget it, I'll never understand. But there are, you know, it's a common question. It probably was in mm-hmm. SWAT mm-hmm. as well. It's mm-hmm. a common question. Like, what's the worst call you've ever run? Have you ever heard that before?
Yeah, of course.
I hear that.
It was a question I wanted to ask you.
Yeah. I've heard that many times. And unfortunately, I feel like I'm stacking them up now. It's like, a lot of them you forget, but there are a few that always stand out. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, you just asked me about my first fire earlier, your first car wreck you run, your hardest event you've ever run, things like that. And there's
maybe the first dead person is mm-hmm. also think something you never forget.
Yeah. I honestly don't remember the first one, first cardiac arrest mm-hmm. or anything like mm-hmm. that. Cause mm-hmm. I guess after you've done CPR so many times,
mm-hmm.
Those all just run together.
Yeah.
They don't stand out as much mm-hmm. as they do when you start mm-hmm. because you run so many of them.
Yeah.
But it's usually the vehicle wrecks, anything dealing with children.
Yeah, of course.
I hope to never, ever run a call on a child, period. But yeah, things happen, right?
Of course, yeah.
So vehicle accidents probably be the worst one I've ever run. Mm. A good friend of mine, I pulled him out of a car dead.
Wow.
He's a fellow firefighter with me.
Mm-hmm.
Him and another firefighter that worked with me were both in the car.
Wow.
And one of them didn't make it. So that's probably the worst incident I've ever run. So,
because of the personal situation, also that it was somebody who was.
Yeah. Like I said, I rode the fire truck with this guy every third shift. And then, I'm at my house one night and my volunteer pager goes off and, it's a vehicle accident and I responded to it and it was him. Yeah, so that has to be the worst one that I've ever run, and talking about that of course helps. But lots of good friends and lots of good support from family, and that helps with those situations.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
My wife's super supportive. Beside me during all of that.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had our child the day of his funeral. So with every death comes new life, right?
Yeah.
So it's crazy what you can live through and grow through. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would say that one definitely stands out the most.
Yeah.
Thank you
for sharing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we switch? I want to discuss one more topic. You yesterday we talked about code blacks or code reds.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is something we are not familiar in Europe. I think
okay.
So I think it's more about
the situation changes a little bit in Germany. Mm-hmm. I think that firefighters get attacked or in some countries in Europe, but, or come into dangerous situation but normally the police is the first on the spot, mm-hmm. or they all come together, but the police clears the situation, yep. and then the firefighters get in.
Okay.
But maybe you can explain what is...
That's being taught by Lieutenant Dave Grossman. Mm-hmm. He has a book called On Combat, and it talks about your stress inoculation and how your body fight, flight, or freeze, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, and how those... how you react in those situations. So they started, your heart rate dictates so much of that in that stress area. So your code red, code black is, you're getting up into the like 160, 170 beats a minute, mm-hmm. and you just fight, flight, or freeze.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember all the scientific terms behind it I can't remember all the terms for the what's going on chemically inside your body, but as everything starts to escape your peripherals, as in like everything starts to go to center when you start to stress out.
Yeah.
So you start losing your hand feeling as much. You start your vision, your hearing leaves you.
Mm-hmm.
It states in there that most shooters or most police involved shootings and active assailant events, they don't even remember hearing the gunshots.
Yeah. I had the situation not by myself. Yeah.
Yep. So what happens is
I had not an active shooter, but right. A colleague of mine mm-hmm. had to shoot in a small flat and
yep.
It must be terribly loud.
Yeah.
I recognized that something is. Mm-hmm. That there is something, but I didn't recognize, okay, he's shooting right now.
Yeah.
So, and it must be terribly loud,
yep.
but you didn't hear it. Sorry, I turned
yeah, and that's, yeah, just one thing. And that's exactly what happens is the first time that you're put in that high stress, area and that heart rate gets up.
Mm-hmm.
Once it gets to about 150 beats per minute,
mm-hmm.
you're not perfusing the oxygen through your body as well.
Yeah.
So now you start losing those fine motor skills.
Yeah.
So, you know, pulling a trigger, mm-hmm. Dropping a magazine out, racking your slide back, all of those things become more difficult unless you train to that level. You can train to be active or you can train through fine motor skills in high stress atmospheres. You have to put yourself there. You have to put your heart rate up to that in order to learn how to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not uncommon for somebody in the military or police to be in their first shooting and use the bathroom on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and things like it's high, very high stress.
Yeah.
Event going on that your body's just got to do what it's going to do. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Your auditory exclusion is a real big one. Like I said, not being able to hear, not remembering hearing, blocking out chunks of it that you don't remember. All of that has to do with your heart rate and the stress. So that's where I wish I had the chart to go over it with you, but definitely get that book or listen to his podcast. He's on many podcasts as well, David Grossman, but,
I will.
Yeah, he talks about how he investigated a lot of school shootings and mass shootings across the world, not just in America, because they happen everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But in America, a mass shooting is, I think, three or more. It's mm-hmm. not – people say mass shooting like it's 100 people every time. Ultimately, it's three or more, I think, is considered mass. When –
We have a different word in German. We have, it's more like, Amoklauf. It's like, it's not about the word mass shooting. It's more about, it's a different word. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
But I think mass pushes.
Yeah.
It makes it sound worse than it really is most of the time. And they're all bad. No matter what, it's all bad. But, he talks about in a lot of those happening, like even the shooters, one of the school shooting, the kid was walking through shooting at people. Mm-hmm. And all it took was, I think it was a principal or a coach, literally looked and said, "Hey, stop."
Wow.
And the kid just put the gun down and walked out.
Wow.
And that's all it took. So sometimes it takes that little bit just to snap somebody out of it, mm-hmm. to snap them out of the rage or snap them out of their code red mm-hmm. or code black or whatever's going on with them. Mm-hmm. And for us, we have to try to train to that level of being under that stress.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, to explain it, I would say in the fire realm to explain it is I make my rookies, "Hey, I tell you what, you go run, give me the fastest lap you can run around the station
yeah.
and then put all of your gear on and then get over here and force this door and mask up."
Yeah.
Cause now your heart rate's jacked because you just took off running. Now you get all your stuff on. So your heart rate is as high as it could possibly be. Now you have to try to do a fine motor skill, like pull your straps tight on your mask mm-hmm. or, manipulate a door lock or things like that. Same thing in his book. He talks about, victims of domestic abuse or victims of, that were murdered, have their cell phone in their hand and it has 911 on it, but they've never hit send.
Wow. Yeah.
Because you're taught dial 911.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now everybody has cell phones. You have to hit send.
Yeah.
And they never hit send or they think they hit send and they're just talking. Mm-hmm. So that stress plays such a big role, in law enforcement and the fire service. If I was to go into a house fire and have a air emergency as I'm running out of air, and can't find my way out.
How does this work? Is there a beep or something?
We have low air alarms on it. So we wear 30-minute air packs.
Yeah.
If you're working hard, that's only 17 to 18 minutes.
Because you're breathing.
Because you're breathing so much harder. Yeah. And when it gets down to, a quarter of a tank, it sends off an alarm and tells us we're on our reserve air.
The heart rate goes up again, maybe.
Yes. So when that, and that will, just that noise alone, will start bringing that heart rate up.
Yeah.
So we have to train to the point of understanding what's going to happen now and how do I calm down? How do I stay calm? The good thing is that that quarter air is a pretty substantial amount of air to get out of most places.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably 7-8 minutes. And if you're in a small house, mm-hmm. I mean, 7-8 minutes is more than enough to turn around and walk out. Mm-hmm. Right. But when we get into a building like a hotel
mm-hmm.
or a, you know, a high rise building, a apartment complex, now we have to be more conscious of how much air is left. So we don't get to that bell ring before we're heading out. But yeah, all of those things play into that stress level and that can send you to that next level of, "Oh crap. I'm about to die," and get that stress level up.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to keep trying to bring it back down and get out of that code black and code red and bring it down, that bring your heart rate down, bring your breathing down. And breathing is the number one way that you can do that. It's just like, in shooting, when you're target shooting or sniper mm-hmm. shooting or, it's all about breathing. It's mm-hmm. box breathing or, counting your breaths, holding your breath, calming everything down to be smooth. You have to figure all of that out so that in that high stress atmosphere, you can do it then too.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. And you bring this in to the training as an instructor. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. I try to teach all this and you have to tell people these things a lot for it to like sink in.
Yeah, of course.
Because until the event hits them,
mm-hmm.
they're just like,
"Well, I have to do this.
Yeah. I don't know this training. This is really a big deal."
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, fall through a floor and see what happens. Right. Yeah. Or, have a rapid fire event and see what happens. Or, you know, be on a medical call and a domestic come out. Like now you're having to defend yourself or, any of those incidents could happen.
Do you have the situations that it gets also dangerous, not because of the fire, but also of people attacking you?
And I know it has happened in some larger cities.
Yeah.
luckily for the fire service is no matter what, we are always there to help.
Yeah.
So they don't have, they don't feel threatened by us. They always feel like we're there to help them.
Mm-hmm.
The only time that it really, that it kind of heads south is if they think that we can do more than what is possible. Mm-hmm. For example, a shooting or something like that, and we can't save the person. Mm-hmm. And then they get mad at us for it.
Yeah.
It got kind of bad during the race stuff over the last couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Being a white male myself showing up, and they're looking at me like I don't care to help them,
mm-hmm.
which is so wrong. Mm-hmm. Like that is I don't care either way. Male, female, black, white, Austrian. I don't care. I'm there to help you. Yeah. I don't care if you're the druggie on the side of the road that's overdosed 15 times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you medication and try to send you to the hospital, and I'm going to talk to you too. I'm going to tell you, hey man, like, you know, you get you some help, man. I don't like seeing you. Like, I've told patients that before.
Yeah.
Had a drunk guy laying in the middle of the road, a couple shifts ago, and I'm trying to sit him up, and he's like, man, I didn't ask for this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't ask to be drunk in the middle of the road. And I was like, well, I understand that, bud. You know, well, there's things that can help you,
yeah.
You know, go to the hospital and get some help. And he's like, man, I don't want to be like this. Hey, I don't want to see you like this, man. I don't want to pick you up out of the street. I don't like seeing you like this either. I'm going to keep coming to help you, but I don't like seeing it either. Get you some help, man.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's not uncommon for them to look at us and, you know, whether drunk, high or neither, and say, we love you guys, man. Thank y'all for what y'all are always here for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, that is just amazing to hear, you know, in the world we live in today. Right.
Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, so, I mean, we're always there to help, and they look at us as that. So it's not as threatening for us. I've heard a department not too far away from us in North Carolina where the guys were starting to do CPR on a guy, and his family member got pissed and said, y'all going to save him or I'm going to shoot you. And that has happened before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the situation that got to that. I don't know if those guys were rude to him to begin with or something. Yeah. I don't know. It's just a odd situation, you know?
Yeah. You're focused on the thing you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe you can be rude. You think it's absolutely normal that because you have your things to do and you have get your stuff together. And
it doesn't help to explain too.
Yeah.
Of course. You know,
They're also in a situation, maybe in a code red or in a code.
Oh, yeah. They're totally in that fight, mm-hmm. flight, or freeze because mm-hmm. they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting when I tell some of this stuff to my wife and she looks at me and says, well, you know, the normal public doesn't know this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, why? Like, I feel like they should because I've seen it. So I feel like they should know this. And, she brings that reality back to me a lot. And it's,
I think if you're on a big convention and somebody breaks down, there will only be a few people
mm-hmm.
who they do something, but because they know how to do it and then they're familiar with it and the other people are in a situation what they have to do now. No?
Yeah.
Maybe they want to help, but they don't know what to do.
Maybe. Yeah. We actually had a vehicle roll over, my last shift and, when I got there, there was like 8 people trying to push the car back on its wheels.
Yeah.
And the car is on its side.
Yeah.
And the lady is sitting inside, like she's laying inside of it.
Yeah.
And they're trying to push the car back on its wheels. And we're like, luckily we had an off duty firefighter there and he's like, no, do not do that.
Mm.
You're going to hurt her. Like that's going to be way worse when it slams down and breaks out of glass. That like, don't do that. She's not under the car. She's just inside the car.
Yeah.
Leave it alone. But you see on TV where cars catch on fire and explode. And a lot of that is just movie magic. The majority of it is more movie magic.
Explosion is not so.
No,
so
it's not.
It
not
does common. Not happen. No.
No.
Burning is happening.
No, burning happens. Yes. But it's super rare.
Mm.
And we respond on wrecks all the time where they say that the car might be on fire. There's smoke coming from the car and it's just the dust from the airbags.
Mm.
'Cause when the airbags go out, dust comes out.
But you have to know this as well.
Yep. So, But yeah, like the normal public is like trying to push this car over, and we're like, they're on the downhill side of the car also. Like the car could roll over and smash all six of them.
Yeah.
It's like, what are y'all doing?
Yeah.
Go away. Yeah. Like, please just step away.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they don't know what they don't know. Yeah. And that's probably for the majority of them have never even seen a vehicle accident in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just doing something hell.
Yeah.
Little do they know that they could be, you know, putting themselves in some extreme danger and just don't even realize it. So I think explaining things way more and, trying to educate the public about what to do, or how to do it is a huge, huge thing. Situational awareness that's huge.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why that's not like taught in when you're growing up.
Yeah.
You know, it's
much more dangerous to stay on the side on the interstate, and you have to go away because.
Yeah, it even comes with you know, walking in sketchy areas like here in Atlanta.
Yeah.
There are some areas where you don't want to be surrounded by a lot of folks, like you know, people high or whatever, and you always got to make that space.
Yeah.
We're walking down the street the other night, and I was telling my wife, make some space, like let's stay away from them farther, you know, and trying to be aware of everything around you.
Yeah.
So you're always a little bit in you have a stronger awareness, maybe, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would, you know, I'm sure in your years in SWAT, that was a big
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And in law enforcement, you definitely have to watch it. Your head has to be on a swivel all the time, always looking around you.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing emergencies for so many years, it's like you can not predict, but you can look at a situation and go, that car could get too close to us right now because I've seen that hit something before. Like I've seen that happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of go away from it. But the normal public doesn't know any different. They've never seen it. They've never been to that arena, I guess. They never had to pay any attention to it before.
Yeah.
But
you're not only a firefighter. You have your own small company, and how have you come to that?
Well, most firefighters in America work a second job because of our schedule.
Yeah.
Our schedule allows us to, that's what the, that's what local government tells you.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you're proactive and you can work another job on your day off. So I got into machining, machining metal parts and CNC work, about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at a few different companies doing that, and actually 100% the support of my wife said, hey, why don't you do this? You're doing good at it and you're progressing with it. So why don't you start your own company?
Mm-hmm.
So we started our own company doing CNC machining, lots of small parts, screws, threads, in the gun industry, firing pins, takedown pins, pivot pins, cool. Things like that.
Yeah.
So, We have a shop at our house and got the machines and started it up about.
Precision machining is your company.
AJ Precision Machining.
We'll put the link in the.
Okay. Cool deal.
In the description of the podcast.
We actually just shortened it to AJ Swiss.
Yeah.
I think AJSwiss.com.
Yeah.
So that's a lot shorter than AJ Precision Machining.
Yeah.
We got so tired of writing that and typing that.
It's a cool company name, I think. Yeah. Okay. We put a link in the description.
Okay. Awesome.
Would it be possible for a European company to get your product, or do you just send it in the US market? Or
I don't see why not. We haven't had any. Yes, but I haven't had that come across yet. So we have to look into shipping and things like that, but I don't see where it would be a problem at all. We'd have to learn more on exchange rate and all of that stuff and how to do internationally. Yeah. But, yes, we'd be more than willing to.
Yeah. So, your experience to create these parts, does this also come a little bit from your work as a firefighter? Is it also, you have also to deal with technical parts, or is it more the jobs you have done?
No, it's the machining industry and manufacturing is totally separate. Nothing really. Now there's stuff in the fire service I could look at and be like, hey, I could just make that part.
Yeah.
But, No, nothing from the fire service has really transferred over. It's all been what I've had to learn on my off days work doing it from other companies.
Mm.
Working for someone else.
Yeah.
So now work for myself.
Great. I really like this. Just here for a few days in the US, I think, and it's a good, people are in a good mood and want to do something, mm-hmm. and to create something. And this
yeah.
is, and this was also a very, cool, conversation we had yesterday. And, I see you're so motivated, and this is something I think we needed more in Europe. It's this kind of motivation is, yeah, I like yeah. this here. Yeah. yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So, Jeremy, I would say thank you so much for joining me in my podcast. We just met yesterday
yes,
and
yeah.
it was a cool conversation. And, also, thank you very much to share that you share. Also emotional things in my podcast, and that you share the kind of work you do here in the US. And I think it will be a very cool episode. And yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Okay, das war Fearless Patched, wie gesagt, aus Atlanta. Und die Firma von Jeremy wird sie dann in der Beschreibung finden. Wir werden einen Link hineinstellen. Schaut auf meine Homepage, fearless-patch.com, und ich freue mich auf die nächste Folge. Danke.